So what I was planning to do here at the start of the theory session is not to overwhelm you with equations or specific models, but rather take the time and perhaps maybe take a step back and wonder what is the current status of the niche theory. And I'm not uniquely equipped for answering that question, but I did a bit of homework and I tried to piece things together. And especially I tried to relate what I think are current opportunities and challenges in niche theory with the perspective of eco-evolutionary dynamics and kind of modern take on quantitative evolution. So bear with me if you are expecting lots of specifics. This is more about background and context. So in particular, I want to make sure that we are all aware of the historical antecedents of our discussion, according to which this workshop is titled, about niche theory. So I will say a few words about that. And then I chose as the organizing principle or the object of conceptual object of discussion that of fitness landscapes, because I think that's very useful in the context of defining niches in a sufficiently dynamical and ecologically embedded way. But then I will also at the end highlight a few challenges where at least I cannot easily see any solution for somehow rescuing the old and perhaps sometimes a bit wishful ideas about niches and their definition against the complexity of modern evolutionary dynamics. So let's see, maybe in the discussion we hear some suggestions from the audience with regard to those. So for a bit of background, what is the niche? By the way, should we say niche or niche? I think the Americans prefer niche. The Brits might prefer niche. And after all, it's a French word. And it comes from niche or se nicher, which translates in English as to nest or to lodge. So it's a cozy place where you feel comfortable. I think that goes rather well with the modern concept of the niche. And then also we have the architectural niche. It's a special place. And we can envisage that each and every species out there in nature finds its own special place. So that gets us fairly far, I think, with regard to defining niches, because all the discussion over the last 100 years, I think, has not changed this basic idea very much and also is still fairly diverse, and you can find proponents of very specialized notions. But the general notion has basically stayed at this level, I would say. As a little jocular excursion, there's also niche marketing. And when you search on the web for niche, actually, these are the major hits. So it's a big thing in economic theory and marketing to target a niche. And it's very much an ecological perspective. There are certain advantages of being a specialist as opposed to a generalist, and that's what niche marketing is about. And then maybe we even have tools coming out of that. There's a micro niche finder, and wouldn't you all want to use that in your ecological research? Okay, back to the ecological perspective, and it starts as so often with our very prescient intellectual ancestor, Charles Darwin, who indeed did not use the word niche, but he very, I think, cogently talked about places in the economy of nature or places in the natural polity of the country. So it's a bit awkward. You see that he was using sociological or economic terms to describe what then was not yet existing in the form of ecological terminology. But basically, he was talking about the ecological role of species. But interestingly, he was using a spatial terminology, places. And that is indicative of the whole discussion about niches. Is it about roles or is it about locations? And that has basically remained unresolved. You still find people referring to niches in the spatial sense and not necessarily in the functional sense. So over the last 150 years, this ambiguity has stayed with us. Grinnell is generally credited with introducing the term niche, and he said a niche is the ultimate distributional unit occupied by just one species or subspecies. And people have interpreted that, and I think it was intended as referring in an amalgamating way both to geographical ranges and to environmental conditions, and therefore ultimately to habitat requirements. So I think that's a respectable modern notion. He was applying it to the California thrasher. He was talking about the niche of that little bird. But it was more in the geographical or location-oriented sense than in the functional sense. And then this is historically often contrasted with the views of Charles Elton, who stressed the functional perspective. He said, an organism's place in the biotic environment, defining the niche, its relations to food and enemies. And then I like this quote here. He wrote, when an ecologist says, there goes a badger, he or she should include in his or her thoughts some definite idea of the animal's place in the community to which it belongs, just as he or she had said, there goes the vicar. Okay, so this is about role, not so much about location. And then Odom quote has a very nice quote, which I think everybody should memorize when it comes to defining niches. He said, if an organism's habitat is its address, the niche is its occupation. So I think I like that best. And this was expounded in the perhaps first textbook on modern ecology published in 1953. Time for a little joke. So the amphibian is asking its colleague, right, if you establish a niche. Again, more the functional role than the location role. Most of us, and including me initially, would start with Hutchinson when defining niches and miss out on this early history. So he was actually talking in a fairly abstract, but therefore also potentially but nevertheless potentially operational way about hypervolumes in spaces of environmental conditions. And he was envisaging little blobs in these high-dimensional spaces and calling these niches. And then he drew attention, I think that was a major advance, not so much the hypervolume, but this one here, to the distinction between the fundamental niche on the one hand and the realized niche on the other. So in a virgin environment, an empty habitat, wherever a species could flourish, that would be part of its fundamental niche, but in the presence of all the other critters hanging around, the space occupied actually in this environment, space of environmental conditions would be much smaller because they would be driven away from certain locations in this space through competition, and then what remains is the realized niche. Then comes Van der Meer with a nice and I think fairly influential review of niche theory published in Annual Reviews, 72, and he abstracted a little bit the idea of Hutchings. He introduced the term partial niche, which basically bridges between the fundamental niche on the one hand and the realized niche on the other. So the fundamental niche is viability in an empty or virgin environment. But now if you add one species, one competitive or whatever, maybe prey or predator to that, and then you reevaluate the viability, then you would talk about the first partial niche that results. And if you add two species, then you talk about the second partial niche. And if you add all n species of the community into your consideration, then you talk about the nth partial niche, which is equivalent to the realized niche. Yeah? So you build a bridge between the fundamental niche and the realized niche in this successive way. And then no discussion of niche theory would be adequate without highlighting the competitive exclusion principle, mathematically introduced by Volterra, then conceptualized or highlighted in its importance, and backed up by some empirical evidence in microcosms by Gauser. Then there was an influential review by Hardin, who said two species with similar ecology cannot live together in the same place in a constant environment. And similar ecology would have to be evaluated in terms of niches. So if they have very similar niches, they cannot coexist. And that ultimately led to the concept of limiting similarity by MacArthur and Levins, which is still very much with us, and we will hear more about that later during this workshop, I believe, at least in Geza's talk. Now, all this has to be embedded in a proper eco-evolutionary framework, so we have not only niche ecology, which is about keeping species traits constant and then evaluating niches, but also niche evolution, which is about the selection process operating on niche boundaries. So a modern theory should also account for that. Okay, second part about fitness landscapes. I will first say a few basic words about how to read the fitness landscape. I think most of you are very familiar with this, but nevertheless. So first of all, evolution is not optimization. So having a static fitness landscape like this one here and then envisaging evolution being describable by gradient ascent on such a static fitness landscape is a very limited account of evolution. What's usually going on is much more interesting and richer, and that is because of frequency-dependent selection and, for that matter, coevolution. So what you really should think about is that you have a current fitness landscape, here illustrated for a univariate phenotype, resulting in selection pressures. They change in the direction of increased fitness. And then, however, as a result of that evolution, also the fitness landscape changes. And it may change in a way that you move towards an ESS, like here. So you're doing best in the environment that you yourself create. It's like a Nash equilibrium. So this complexity arises because of eco-evolutionary feedback. You have a resident community. They create or determine the current environment, which is then experienced by variant phenotypes, who can then, depending on their experience, either invade or not. Now, these fitness landscapes are fairly versatile. You can talk about ecological equilibration when here a particular species or a particular phenotype has positive fitness, it grows. So it's not at equilibrium, it has growing abundance. If, on the other hand, it has negative fitness, its abundance is shrinking, so that when you want to talk about the ecological equilibrium, by definition, all the resident types must be at zero fitness. On that basis, you can define ecological stability in terms of fitness landscapes. You can consider perturbations now around that ecological equilibrium. So you make the population a bit larger, and then if its fitness is negative, it will become smaller again. And you can make it a bit smaller, and if its fitness is positive, it will become larger again, so you have an ecologically stable situation. And obviously the opposite case is evident. This would be ecological instability evaluated in terms of fitness landscapes. But that is not all. That's the ecological side so far. Now for the evolutionary side, so again we start from a fitness zero phenotype, which therefore is at ecological equilibrium. And we can immediately assess the directional selection operating on that phenotype. And once that directional selection has ceased, what may remain is either disruptive selection, if the phenotype is at a fitness minimum, or naturally stabilizing selection. So also that works very well in terms of these variable fitness landscapes. What is a bit more subtle, and that means it's also one reason why the term evolutionary stability that Maynard Smith introduced is a bit of a misnomer, because it only considers this question of stabilizing versus disruptive selection. That's the question of convergent stability. So if you have such a phenotype and then you displace it deliberately by some perturbation, and then selection pressures are pointing backwards to where it was from either side, then you have a convergent stable phenotype. So that's part of the overall stability of an evolutionary outcome. And the reverse is obviously this situation where you displace it a bit, but then it experiences selection pressures in the wrong direction and goes away from the former location. So on that basis, we can define evolutionary stability, and we can define community closure. So here we now have a community of two phenotypes. They are both at ecological equilibrium, and they are both at evolutionary equilibrium in the sense of local evolutionary stability. And no other part of the fitness landscape is sticking out above zero. So this is a closed community. No other species can invade. Whereas this would be an open community where in phenotypes in this phenotypic range can invade. They have positive fitness. So we can immediately assess by looking at the fitness landscape the invasion range or the open niches, to come back to the terminology we are trying to elucidate. We can also assess, which is now missing here, the invasion speed. So the higher this is above the zero line, the more likely this invasion will be successful. And we can assess the initial adaptation of the invader, which is up the fitness landscale. So in summary, now the geometry of frequency-dependent fitness landscapes naturally permits us to assess all sorts of things which are relevant for understanding niches, which are ecological equilibration, ecological stability, evolutionary equilibration, evolutionary stability, convergence stability, and community closure. And in the absence of community closure, fitness landscapes also reveal open niches, the speed or likelihood of their being invaded, and the initial direction of invader adaptation. So it's fairly versatile, as I was claiming initially. Now, with that toolbox, we can understand things like evolutionary branching, which most of you, I think, are well familiar with. So sometimes convergence stability and evolutionary stability don't agree. So in this situation, fitness is increasing to the left, so therefore the phenotype moves to the left. But then this fitness minimum is catching up with the evolving phenotype, and we end up in a situation like this, where we have convergence to a fitness minimum, or, in other words, convergence to disruptive selection. Very much counterintuitive when one is used to think in terms of static fitness landscape, where this can never happen. What happens after reaching the branching point? Here you can see this fitness landscape as slices, and you see the evolutionary trajectory as the red curve and the fitness minimum as the blue curve. So you see it catches up with the phenotype, creating disruptive selection, which in turn then produces two branches, and they eventually experience stabilizing selection. So we can say, I think, with good reason, that now we have two niches here, which did not exist before. So actually this is a process of niche construction resulting from evolutionary branching. Let me carry on with a few more illustrations now in two dimensions. So we consider two functional traits, a trait space with two functionally relevant dimensions. For the sake of the argument, we consider some sort of unimodal carrying capacity, so two extreme trait values are not viable. And we consider local competition in the trait space, so anybody having similar traits, and therefore similar niches, you might say, will compete more strongly. And with this little setup, one already gets quite a menagerie of interesting outcomes. Now I've put the fitness on the vertical axis and I've color-coded it. So the horizontal space is the two-dimensional trait space, vertical is fitness, and the color indicates the fitness, with bright colors being positive and dark colors being negative. So we get a picture that's evocatively reminiscent of a seascape with some sea and some mountains or land areas or islands, and the species are sitting right at the shoreline being these black circles. So now I just threw in a few species into this two-dimensional space, removed those that went extinct or let them go extinct, and plotted the rest. So what can we learn from that? We can learn that every species is at ecological equilibrium now in this picture and evolving towards the land, yeah, just like the amphibians trying to get out of the water, trying to climb up the islands. And all this area, which is in bright color, is open niche space. So you might want to say this: yeah, there are two large open niches in this community. So random invasion or random immigration is very bad in closing communities. It's exceedingly unlikely, I think, that especially in higher dimensions this works. And to prove that point, let me throw in a few more invaders. Maybe now instead of 10 initially, 100. But most go extinct. And the few that remain still don't manage to close even this two-dimensional niche space. So it's really pathetic. They're not able to close the space without the aid of gradle evolution, which is then what I activated next. So they still have these three islands or open niches which are open to immigration. So now the picture starts to look perhaps a bit more like what we would expect. Now I've allowed these few species to climb the land masses and to eventually end up as kings of their own hill. And even that is not closing the community, because we still have this island sticking out over the sea level, and this means the community can still be invaded. But locally, I think we can now reasonably claim that we have niches. Yeah, so I think this is the most obvious interpretation of niche in the eco-evolutionary context. Once we have evolutionary equilibration, at least in the sense of convergent stability and local evolutionary stability, then these fitness tips or fitness peaks are very natural objects referred to as niches. Okay, and then if we allow the population, the community, to respond to disruptive selection, which I didn't in the previous picture, so now I allow evolutionary branching, then finally the community gets closed. Yeah, so there's no island sticking out above the sea level, and every species is at its own local hill. So that shows you, I think, quite convincingly, that even with such a simple and trivial toy model, speciation is critical for understanding community structure, especially when we are talking about reasonably close communities that are fairly immune to further invasions. Now, this was just by way of theoretical illustrations. I'm now running through very quickly through three models in which we have empirically calibrated the fitness landscape. So we have built an ecological or population dynamical model which is supposed to really mimic specific systems, and then we look at the resultant fitness landscapes. So this is work mainly by Daniel Falster, also Auke Brennström, who is involved. And the two functional traits chosen here are those which are very important for understanding forest ecology. It's leaf mass per area, something like leaf thickness, and the height at which seeds are first produced. And then you see initially the island that can be colonized is all this space. And you have a single global evolutionary attractor. So you could argue, okay, you have a single niche. If you start from a vacant environment, there's a single niche, it's this optimum. But then once you allow one species to reach this, the island has changed its shape. So this is the part that sticks out, that has positive fitness. And you can now consider successive colonizations through immigration. And then we have two species. And the island structure again changes. And we have three species. And we can continue this game to about five or six species until the community is closed. And this model is fairly realistic. It does model the canopy structure of a forest. And you get some canopy trees and some understory trees. And after perturbations, you first get fast growth of the kind of, fast growers, and then you have those that are more robust colonizing the understory. So by looking at this, we can immediately see, yes, we have ecological equilibrium, and if you could see the height of these fitness islands, you could see we also have evolutionary equilibrium. Second example is from aquatic insects, done with Korean colleagues and Rupert Matsuko, who is also in the audience. And it's about speciation or adaptive radiation along rivers where you have insects specializing on slow-flowing water in pools or fast-flowing water in riffles. And what is interesting about this example is that you may think there are two niches here, the pool niche and the riffle niche. And when you model that, you find that once these are occupied, but only then, an intermediate niche opens up. Only then. So it's again niche construction. And another example from a lake in the vicinity of Berlin, we plugged in all sorts of measurements about the ecology of two corrigonids that are recognized as separate species, and we could replicate their niches on their ability to coexist because they were sufficiently dissimilar after evolution in terms of their niches. And the depth profile, yeah, so they differentiate according to depth, is closely matching the empirical system. So I was happy to hear from Olaf's talk that lakes with greater depth have more radiation potential. Such a model might be used to investigate that from a theoretical angle. Okay, and with that, I come now to the third part about the challenges. So far, I think we have learned that niches very naturally integrate with fitness landscapes. Basically, we have fitness peaks. If they're at zero, then that means they're occupied or filled niches. When they stick out above zero, that means they're not sufficiently occupied or even vacant. So that is all, I think, well integrated. We can also talk about fundamental niches. When we remove all the species and study the fitness landscape, or we can bring in selected species to study partial niches in terms of fitness landscape, or we can throw in everybody at the same time. And then we hopefully get the realized niches of those that can coexist. But now for a few stumbling stones, and I think they mean that the niche concept really has some limitations which modern evolutionary dynamics overcomes, but I'm not so sure how it can be extended to accommodate these limitations, but maybe you have ideas. So the first is when you don't go to a static evolutionary equilibrium, if you go to a non-equilibrium evolutionary tractor, so incessant, persistent co-evolution, or using a simile coming from Lewis Carroll's writing, Alice Through the Looking Glass, Red Queen evolution. So one thing that we already know since 15 or 20 years is the possibility of evolutionary cycling and predator-prey interactions. A prey is evolving away from a predator, reducing its exposure to predation. The predator is trying to catch up, and they engage in an endless cycle and a periodic alteration of their traits. And as part of my master thesis, actually, I was trying to show that this is not an artifact of overly simplified models. So it does happen in gradient-based models, but it also happens in random walk models and individual-based models. So at least at that level of scrutiny, it does seem to be a fairly robust phenomenon. There's also another phenomenon that maybe one could call laminar coevolution. Over evolutionary time, traits are branching first under the influence of asymmetric competition. And then you get some species that, for example, evolve large body sizes, but eventually they run out of carrying capacity, which is a phenomenon already elucidated by Matsuda and Abrahams in 1994. But here it's done in a context of community coevolution, and evolutionary branching is included. So you get a constant stream of extinction at large body size, say, but also a constant replenishment of biodiversity at small body sizes. And I think if you would find such a pattern with such wonderful resolution in the fossil record, most people would attribute it to environmental change, secular change. But it's all internally driven. There's nothing else going on here but asymmetric competition. The abiotic environment is constant. So how to define niches in such context is not so clear, because areas where fitness is currently positive is only including the realized species at the margin, but they are not filling these areas. So I'm not sure. Perhaps one can stretch it and say the realized niche is actually limited by the speed of evolution, and therefore we get these patterns. And the second challenge is resulting from species packing. We tend to think, at least those of us working on evolutionary branching related studies, that discreteness of morphs is pretty much the rule, and I think it is. But recent research, including Simone Pigliotti's research, who will talk also later today, has revealed the importance of competition kernels in shaping either the discreteness or the continuity of species. So here you have an example of a competition kernel that is platykurtic. It's a bit bulky, tends towards a box kernel. And it does result in nicely, evenly spaced species, which are indicated by the blue lines. The fitness landscape is shown in green. So again, each species in this pecking scenario is sitting at the top of its own hill. And now the key is that the Fourier transform of this competition kernel dips below zero. It is not positive definite, to use a technical term, and that is a key criterion for species clustering. So with not positive definite competition kernels, which therefore have negative Fourier components, you can get species clustering, but otherwise not. And the counterexample is shown here, a leptokurtic competition kernel, more needle-shaped, with fat tails, though, has a positive Fourier transform, and therefore we find that species can be packed infinitely closely. Limiting similarity does not apply. Limiting similarity only applies for non-positive definite competition. And then it goes further. The classical theory let us expect that this, at least the distance of species packing, is unique. But also that is not the case. We can run adaptive radiations, and we find that for certain initial conditions, let's say we start from these initial spacing, we get a unique final spacing. Also from these initial spacings, we get a unique final spacing. But there is a neutral band in between where different spacings are both evolutionary stable and convergence stable. So that's a bit of a surprise. And finally, also not so easy to deal with from the niche perspective, we have sexual reproduction. And that may cause species to remain cohesive even if they would split under asexual reproduction, which means they may sit at a fitness minimum and not branch. And that's akin to a source sink population. So the tails of the distribution have positive fitness, and they replenish the bulk of the distribution, which is at a fitness minimum, therefore has negative fitness. So how to define a niche here is really not obvious, because you're really clearly at a fitness minimum and not at a fitness maximum, and yet you stay there. And then, as a further bummer for limiting similarity and the idea that you need ecological differentiation for coexistence, here's some recent research I did with guys from UBC, Leeson McGonigal and Sally Otto, and we just consider a spatial habitat that's slightly modulated in terms of its carrying capacity, which you see here. So some spaces are a bit more high carrying capacity than some other spaces. And then all we add to this model is a bit of sexual selection. So if you are the wrong guy, you are not selected for reproduction. And then we get coexisting species that are fully ecologically equivalent. Yeah, so there's no problem to coexistence of fully ecologically equivalent species with a bit of environmental heterogeneity and sexual selection. So that goes against the grain of niche thinking. Okay, with that I come to the summary. I hope to have illustrated that frequency-dependent fitness landscapes offer an integrative perspective on niche ecology and evolution. We can conceive vacant niches as ranges of positive fitness. And at evolutionary equilibria, the realized niches correspond to local fitness minima. However, whether realized niches can be meaningfully defined during evolutionary transients or for source sink structures, at least as far as I'm concerned, remains to be studied. Thank you.
Maybe time for one question. Was there one question, please?
Why do we need niches?
That's a good question. I think that's, I was driving a little bit implicitly towards the point that maybe the term has outlived its usefulness, but I think that would be a fairly harsh and brutal conclusion, because so many people, including I think myself and many of my colleagues, like to think in terms of niches. It's an intuitive concept. We cannot easily define it, but we all have a feeling we know what it is when we see it. So I must say, I would be more comfortable with trying to come up with a modern definition of the niche that is compatible with all these results and all these intricacies, and just put it on a firm grounding that can continue to be useful in the 21st century.
The niche really in the substance paradigm is what you were talking about, rather than the process-based thinking.
Yeah, I think we need both, right? And I wouldn't attribute niche to either. I think niches are very much part of process-based thinking, but you could probably call them substance-based if you want to.
All right, thanks.